fight in the fields and in the streets. We shall fight in the hills. We shall never surrender.
Господин представитель, это что, для вас открытие? Весь мир знает, что самая империалистическая держава – это Соединенные Штаты Америки.
Yesterday, December 7, 1941, a date which will live in infamy.
Welcome to the second episode of Traces Through Time, a brand new podcast highlighting the greatest historical figures and events in an easily accessible format for all listeners. I'm Mahip Mahil, and today we'll be going through the final part of our series on Alexander the Great. If you're interested in learning more about Alexander, I recommend listening to the first episode, where we covered everything from his birth and early life all the way to his victory over the Persian king Darius at the Battle of Issus. As we continue our journey, I wanted to review the traits of Alexander and what actually made him the great. His ambition, energy, and fearless leadership were completely unparalleled by anyone in his time, and perhaps anyone in history. At 16 years old, Alexander had already begun leading armies and destroying rebellions, and, by the time he was 32, his empire spanned from Greece to India, and from Egypt to Uzbekistan. His courage was like no other. Alexander was frequently the first man leading the charge. Now, I did say last episode that I wanted you to take away all these traits. His ambition, his energy, leadership, courage, and sometimes even stubbornness are also hugely important everywhere. From business and your career to even your personal life and goals. As always, I want you to realize the importance of these as you listen, but I also want you to understand the potential danger of these traits. What happens when these traits completely overtake your life? What happens when you're too stubborn or too forceful? Sometimes we may displease people, and that may be okay, but only to a certain point. As you'll see later in this episode, all this didn't work out too well for Alexander by the end of his life. Now, let's get into it. As last time, I used the Anabasis of Alexander by Arrian, the Histories of Alexander the Great by Quintus Curtius Rufus, and the Life of Alexander by Plutarch as my main sources. Various modern estimates have also been added. These sources have all been listed on the show notes if you'd like to do some more research of your own. Now, let's pick up where we left off in episode 1, with Alexander's stunning victory over the Persians at the Battle of Issus. The Persian army had been obliterated at Issus, suffering nearly 20 to 40,000 casualties. In comparison, the Macedonians only suffered about 5,000 casualties, with only 150 soldiers killed. Ptolemy, Alexander's general, noted that the amount of Persian dead filled an entire ravine upon which the army could cross. Moreover, Darius had left his entire camp behind. In this camp were his mother, his wife, the queen, his two daughters, and even an infant son. Darius, the Shanshah of the Persian Empire, so sure of his victory against the mere 23-year-old Macedonian, had brought his entire family, as if it was an adventure. However, now, they were in the hands of Alexander. Yet Alexander treated them very well. He made royal preparations for them, and at some point, he had so much affection for Darius' mother that he himself began calling her my mother. Darius, however, realizing that he couldn't take on Alexander with the scattered remains of his Persian army, offered Alexander a peace treaty. He offered an alliance, all of the lands Alexander had already conquered, and a ransom of 10,000 talents of silver for his wife, mother, and children, as well as a marriage offer between Darius' daughter and Alexander. The two could have ruled Asia side by side, bonded by marriage and family. However, Alexander refused, telling Darius, "Whatever you send to me as the king of Asia, and do not address to me your wishes as to an equal." There's a famous story related to this that when Parmenion, possibly Alexander's greatest military advisor, heard of the peace offer, he said if he was Alexander, he would accept. Alexander took one look at his wise general and replied that if he was Parmenion, he would accept too. Since he was Alexander, he didn't want part of the Persian Empire. He was coming for it all. In Alexander's mind, he had already become the rightful king of Asia. And to be fair, this was starting to become true. Alexander hereby took control over the rest of the Levant, including present-day Lebanon and Syria, as well as the ancient city of Damascus. But he found intense resistance in the old city of Tyre, in present-day southern Lebanon. Tyre was an island several kilometers from the coast of Lebanon, with walls right up to the sea. Unlike most other cities in the Levant, Tyre had refused to surrender to Alexander, and the Persians still had some form of naval supremacy over this part of the Mediterranean. Alexander resolved to make a land causeway, or basically a natural bridge, made from stone all the way from the mainland to the island city, reaching nearly 1 kilometer in length and 200 feet in width. He then moved his artillery onto the causeway, placing them on tall siege towers, thereby giving his artillery, consisting mainly of catapults and ballista, range over the city walls. Yet all while the causeway was still being constructed, the Tyrians attacked the construction crews using fireships, slowing down the advance of the Macedonians to a mere crawl. But finally, after 7 brutal months, the city was captured. Alexander, furious that the Tyrians had held up the Macedonian army for a whole 7 months, killed 8,000 Tyrian soldiers, 2,000 of which he had crucified on the beaches of the island city. Moreover, 30,000 civilians were sold into slavery, mostly women and children. Alexander's lines of communication and supply were now secure, all the way back to Greece. Now, Alexander began to descend into the ancient land of Egypt. But before he could advance any further, he came to resistance at the fortress at Gaza. Besieging it, this time Alexander resolved that he would not take 7 months here, too. He had learned from Tyre, and used the same siege engines and tactics. Within 4 assaults in the month of October, Gaza had fallen. Just like Tyre, men of military age were put to the sword, while everyone else was sold into slavery. News of Alexander's advance had spread far and wide, reaching Egypt. The Egyptians knew of the coming conqueror from Greece, and when Alexander finally did reach the land, Egypt simply handed itself over to the new king of Asia. The Egyptians welcomed Alexander as a liberator of sorts, who shook off the oppressive authority of Darius's Persians. Even Darius's viceroy in Egypt, or his satrap, welcomed the new king of Asia, surrendering the entire region. Alexander first went to Memphis, where he made sacrifices to the ancient Egyptian gods. It was here where Alexander was crowned the Pharaoh of Egypt. He then went off to the coast and stopped at a location right on the Mediterranean Sea, at the mouth of the Nile River Delta. According to Arrian, he was so impressed by the location that he decided to found a city, the famous Alexandria. Alexander then traveled west, towards the Libyan desert, stopping at the Siwa Oasis to meet the famous oracle Amun-Ra. The oracle told prophecies to all, and upon meeting Alexander, told him that he was a son of the king of gods, Amun. Amun was the equivalent of the king of gods in Greece, Zeus. After the meeting, Alexander simply stated that the oracle's words satisfied his wishes. The son of the king of gods had now decided to make his way back towards the Middle East. However, the Pharaoh of Egypt would never return. After a brief stop in Tyre, where he received news that a Spartan rebellion back home had been put down in the Battle of Megalopolis by Antipater, Alexander's regent in Macedonia, Alexander received news that Darius had reformed another army, this one much bigger than the last, and was waiting for Alexander in Mesopotamia, or present-day Iraq. He left Tyre and began making his way towards the Euphrates River in Mesopotamia, the cradle of civilization. Yet after crossing the ancient river, instead of going straight towards the capital of the Persian Empire, Babylon, Alexander took the northern route towards modern-day northern Iraq, towards the river Tigris. Alexander crossed the Tigris and rested his army. While still encamped there, Alexander received news from captured Persian scouts that Darius' new Persian army was only 8 miles away. But instead of quickly charging there, Alexander realized Darius wasn't going to run now, and thus allowed his men to rest for 4 whole days. Parmenion had earlier suggested to Alexander to launch a surprise attack in the night. Alexander, however, refused, wanting to show that he could beat a much larger force all by himself in the daylight. It was the 1st of October, 331 BC, and the battlefield near the modern-day city of Mosul had been purposely chosen by Darius beforehand. It was a prime location for his huge numbers, unlike at the narrow pass at Issus. The battlefield was flat, and Darius had ordered his men beforehand to clear it of any shrubs or bushes. This way, his world-renowned chariots and cavalry, much greater in number than Issus, and much greater in number than Alexander's, could operate freely. Arrian says the Persian army numbered more than 1 million men in total. In reality, it was probably only 50,000 to 120,000. Yet, it probably still outnumbers Alexander's mere 45,000 by more than 2 to 1. The Persian army at Gaugamela was essentially a coalition of forces from all over the empire, containing Bactrians, Armenians, Sogdians, Scythians, Ercodians, and even some Indian elephants. Darius' cavalry apparently numbered 40,000, and he had nearly 200 chariots in the army. The Persian left wing was made entirely of Bactrian cavalry, headed by the Bactrian satrap, Bessus. Next to this was mixed infantry and cavalry, while the right flank was also full of cavalry. The chariots lined the front of the battle line with the infantry, Syrian and Babylonian, in the back. The odds were stacked against Alexander. Yet, this, as we've already seen, is when he usually shines. Alexander put together his battle line in much the same way as he had done in battles prior, with Alexander leading the companion cavalry, as well as a number of other Greek cavalry and elite infantry on the right wing, while Parmenion commanded the cavalry on the left. The Greek phalanx remained the centerpiece of the line, and Alexander had already begun devising up a plan. Instead of drawing up his men face to face, parallel with Darius' battle line, he had put his line on an angle. Alexander began to give a rousing speech to his officers, saying the upcoming battle was not for Syria, not for Egypt, or not even for Phoenicia. This battle was for the whole of Asia. Horns blasted as the hearts of men on the dusty battlefield pounded. Immediately, in his trademark method, Alexander charged and took his cavalry wing out to the right, reaching near the boundary where the battlefield had been cleared. The Persians, wholly confused, wondered if Alexander was seriously trying to outflank the massive Persian military. The Persians thus took part of their own center and their entire left flank and countercharged at Alexander to deter him from leaving the carefully chosen battlefield. Alexander, seeing his trap had worked, finally wheeled about and ordered the other Greek cavalry and elite infantry under his command to charge and hold the Persians. Meanwhile, In the center of the battlefield, the Greek infantry had begun marching towards the enemy line. Darius, noting that Alexander was still a distance away, took a chance and ordered the charge of the chariots. The Persian war chariots sped towards the Greek phalanx, the horses facing down the 18-foot sarissa spears of the hardened Macedonian warriors. However, the Greek archers and javelin men easily took out many riders of the chariots before they could even reach the other side. And for the chariots that did make it to the Greek line, the phalanxes simply opened up lanes for them to pass through. The Greek infantry in the rear then encircled and destroyed the remaining chariots. Darius's ace had been neutralized. All while this happened, Alexander had disengaged himself from the huge cavalry battle on the Greek right flank and took his companions and joined up with some elite Greek infantry. Then, wheeling about, the Hellenic cavalry and infantry mix charged at the weakened center as a giant wedge, with Alexander at the forefront, straight as an arrow. The Persian center, seeing the new Greek onslaught, began to collapse. Alexander pointed his spear towards the Persian king, Darius, determined to finally take down his enemy. When seeing this, I think you can guess what Darius did. Just like at Issus, Darius turned around in his chariot and fled the battlefield. Alexander, seeing the great king escape, attempted to chase him down, but he couldn't for too long. The Macedonian left under Parmenion was in serious danger of being completely encircled and wiped out by the right flank of the Persian cavalry. Alexander had a significant choice to make: save his general but let Darius escape, or run down the Persian king while losing arguably his most trusted general. Alexander chose the former. Arrian describes this as where the fiercest fighting of the entire Battle of Gaugamela took place, as Alexander made his way back to the left wing with his faithful companion cavalry and attacked the strongest horse divisions of the entire Persian army, the Parthians and the Indians. It was brutal fighting. 60 of Alexander's elite horsemen, the companions, fell, while hundreds others were injured. But as news of Darius's escape reached the rest of the Persians, the Persian army finally began to flee. It was just like Issus. Alexander had pulled off the impossible, again. Nearly 40 to 90,000 Persians lay dead, injured, or captured, while the Greeks suffered barely 1,500 casualties. In the aftermath of the battle, Alexander chased down Darius as far as the tip of present-day Iraq. But Darius had gotten away, escaping to the city of Ecbatana and Media, or now called northwestern Iran. He planned to raise another army from the eastern provinces and fight again. Yet, Gaugamela would be the last time Alex and Darius faced each other on the battlefield. Alexander then marched into the capital city of the entire Persian Empire, Babylon. Once the city's garrison had received news of Alexander's stunning victory, they immediately surrendered to their new Greek overlord, surrendering their entire treasury and nearby lands. In turn, Alexander was benevolent to the Babylonians. Then, marching on eastwards, he took Susa, one of the ceremonial capitals of the Persian Empire, taking its entire treasury, numbering up to 50,000 talents of gold and silver, as well as the royal lands and palaces. On his way, he also conquered the Uxian tribe, which controlled the mountain passes leading to the rest of the empire. The Persians themselves had never been able to defeat this tribe, and were always required to pay a fee to pass through. However, in a matter of months, Alexander did what the Persians could not do for centuries. After Babylon and Susa fell, Alexander began to make his way to the ancient ceremonial Persian capital of Persepolis, a city of opulent palaces and stunning architecture. But while traveling to the ancient city through the Zagros Mountains, the mountain range separating Iran from Iraq, Alexander's army was stopped in a narrow pass called the Persian Gates by nearly 40,000 Persians. They, desiring to delay Alexander's advance, had built a wall across the narrow mountain pass. Here, the Macedonians were held up for nearly a month before finally learning of a path behind the army They took this path by the night, then cut off and annihilated the 40,000 Persians. Ironically, this, in many ways, was a situation very similar to that of Thermopylae, nearly a century earlier, where the 300 Spartans were cut off and annihilated by the Persian army. The road to Persepolis was finally open. Yet, according to Arrian, when Alexander finally entered the breathtaking city of Persepolis, Alexander wanted vengeance for the razing of Athens and the destruction of the Greek Acropolis at the hands of Xerxes and his Persians more than a century ago. Modern sources now say he allowed his soldiers to loot the ancient city for days. Meanwhile, a major fire had started in one of the palaces. This quickly began to spread to the rest of the city. This fire may have been started at Alexander's own command, or may have just been an accident. The answer is, no one really knows. Nevertheless, Curtius and Plutarch state that, however it may have started, Alexander began to regret his decision by morning. He ordered his men to put out the fire, but by this time, the flames had engulfed the city. At Persepolis, Alexander took a moment now to organize his vast new kingdom. He wanted to maintain the continuity of the old Persian system in order to further legitimize himself and his rule, and so kept most existing satraps and viceroys in their place. Then, after spending a few months at Persepolis, Alexander began to chase down Darius, first coming north to Media, where Darius was hiding in the city of Ecbatana. Before he reached the city, however, Darius had fled eastward to Parthia, or modern-day Iran and Afghanistan. Alexander and his army followed right behind him. But now, in July 330 BC, Darius was facing intense internal pressure. Mutiny was brewing at an unstoppable pace within his own officer corps. Bessus, the viceroy of Bactria and the man who had led the Persian left flank at Gaugamela, led a plot of officers who, at once, arrested the king Darius. Then, realizing Alexander was not far off, Bessus decided to execute Darius and leave his body by the side of the road. Bessus declared himself to be the new Shanshah of Persia, and the only legitimate ruler of the Persian Empire. Then, as quickly as possible, he escaped to the eastern provinces. Alexander, however, instead of being thankful that his arch-nemesis had been finally finished off, was furious. You might be thinking, why? Darius was Alexander's only remaining competitor in terms of still having a valid claim to the throne of Persia. But it's likely that Alexander wanted to keep Darius around to show the rest of the empire that Alexander was truly the legitimate successor of Darius. Moreover, it seems that Alexander actually began to respect Darius a little bit, possibly due to his high status or even his attitude of never fully giving up and surrendering to Alexander. Alexander thus declared Bessus a king killer, a man who had committed the most unholy of sins, regicide. He then ordered that Darius be buried along with his predecessor Persian kings at the tombs of Persepolis. Now, Alexander set out east to destroy the usurper Bessus and finally conquer the entirety of the Persian Empire. The very first thing Alexander did when he arrived in the eastern provinces of the Persian Empire, all the way in Central Asia, was to create some more cities. This is what he does. Alexander came to Arya, or present-day northwest Afghanistan, where he formed the ancient city of Alexandria Ariana, the first of many cities to come in the eastern provinces of the empire. Then, in southeastern Afghanistan, he formed the city of Alexandria Arachosia, now the famous Afghan city of Kandahar. Finally, in 329 BC, Alexander arrived in Bactria, which consists of parts of modern-day Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, and northeastern Afghanistan, to fight Bessus. However, there would be no fight. Absurdly, Bessus, the usurper, who had literally just backstabbed his own king, was, in turn, backstabbed by his own general, a man called Spidamenes. Spidomenes turned over the king killer to Alexander. Alexander, as punishment for his sins, had Bessus stripped naked, bound by a wooden collar, and tortured. Then, Alexander sent Bessus back to Persia in order to be executed as a king killer. Now that both Darius and Bessus were out of the picture, Alexander remained in these eastern provinces to ensure his rule was recognized within all parts of the Persian Empire. These regions, specifically Bactria and Sogdia, frequently revolted against their rulers, and also suffered raids from its northern neighbors, the Scythians. The Scythians were tribes of nomads, known for their mastery of horses, which they utilized alongside their hit-and-run cavalry tactics to wreak havoc upon the frontier Persian provinces. To consolidate his rule, Alexander took the city of Marakanda, the capital of Sogdia, in present-day Tajikistan. Then he reached the banks of the Jaxartes River and, guess what, founded another city called Alexandra Escate, meaning Alexander the Furthest, since Alexander had now reached the furthest extent of the Persian Empire. But while Alexander was at the Jaxartes, Sogdia and parts of Bactria, as was usually expected, went into open rebellion. With his trademark speed and energy, Alexander took his army and launched a siege of the largest rebel city, Sierapolis, and took it in only a matter of days. 8,000 rebels died in only the first phase of the siege, with the rest surrendering in the next few days due to low supplies. Then, further proving his own energy and leadership, Alexander seized 4 other cities in only 2 days by siege. The remaining Sogdian rebels, seeing Alexander's ferocity on the battlefield, fled. In October 329 BC, Alexander began to make plans to stamp out the Scythian nomad threat. They had begun their frequent raids across the northern border of the Jaxartes. Drawing the Scythians into battle, Alexander trapped and fought them at the Battle of the Jaxartes, near the present-day capital of Uzbekistan, Tashkent. In one fell swoop, he had killed 1,200 Scythian raiders, as well as their skilled commander. Enticing, pinning down, and annihilating a raiding army was a feat that no other major ruler had ever achieved. Scythia had now been quelled. But now, Spidomenes, the man who had turned over Bessus the king killer, had also gone into open rebellion. To Alexander and to the rest of the Greeks, it seemed endless with these folk, all of the betrayal and the backstabbing and the murder. And in reality, it really was. The Central Asian provinces throughout history have been the most difficult nations to consolidate power over. Alexander, at first thinking Spidomenes was a slight inconvenience, sent a force under one of his smaller commanders to defeat the rebels, who he didn't pay much attention to. However, this force was obliterated. It became obvious that Spidomenes was indeed a fierce and direct threat to Alexander in Sogdia and Bactria. Wherever he went, he instigated rebellions against Alexander's Macedonian rule. Spidomenes, however, was also quite shrewd. He evaded direct war with Alexander, instead ambushing the Greeks where he didn't face much opposition. This method, a mix of ambushing and guerrilla tactics, was sophisticated for its time. Alexander, becoming further furious at the amount of time it was taking him to put down just a local rebel, pursued him further into the countryside of Sogdia. Finally, only in 328 BC, about 2 years after Alexander had begun the chase of Darius, Spidomenes, insanely again, was beheaded by his own men, who in turn surrendered to Alexander. Yet now, there is no one else in the Persian Empire except Alexander. Persia was finally his. You'll remember me saying just earlier that, to Alexander, continuity was extremely important. In his mind, this was the only way to fully pacify the Persian state and its people, and to consolidate his own rule. For instance, Alexander began to adopt Persian traditions and customs so he could appeal to his new Persian subjects. However, the majority of his Greek court and officers believed these customs were inferior and shouldn't be tolerated by the socially nobler Greeks. Alexander especially crossed a line when he began wearing variations of Persian clothing, as well as demanding that Greeks act out proskynesis, a mainly Persian custom, whereby subjects show their respect and servitude to the king. The Greeks in Alexander's court were furious, believing only gods deserve this type of respect, and Alexander, at least to them, was no god. Alexander was forced to back down with this demand of proskynesis. But even before Alexander entered Central Asia, he had begun to show signs of his tyrannical nature. Parmenion, arguably one of Alexander's most trusted generals, who had accompanied the young king in all of his major battles, from the Granicus to Gaugamela, was in serious trouble. His son, Philotas, the commander of the Campanian cavalry, another one of Alexander's trusted advisors, had learned of a plot against Alexander's life. But instead of immediately telling his king, Philotas had done nothing. When Alexander found out that Philotas had remained quiet, he had him, as well as the others in the conspiracy, all arrested, tortured, and finally killed. The death of his son meant even the poor Parmenion, who was stationed at Ecbatana and had nothing to do with the plot, also had to be killed. So, even before Parmenion received news of his son's demise, he was assassinated on Alexander's orders. However, this wasn't even the beginning of Alexander's purges. It was around 328 BC in Marikanda, the capital of Sogdia, that Clytus the Black, the man who had saved Alexander's life all the way back at the Battle of the Granicus, was killed personally by Alexander. Drunk and filled with fury, Clytus had accused and assaulted the king at a party. Alexander, enraged at his dear friend's outburst, took a javelin from one of the guards and threw it at Clytus, piercing him in the chest. Clytus bled out and died within a matter of minutes. According to Arrian and Plutarch, when Alexander finally came to his senses, he massively grieved the death of not only the man who had saved his life, but also one of his friends. He refused to eat or drink, and he began to cry out his name in the middle of the night. But there is still one more act of tyranny Alexander committed, and the plot of the pages, a page which is formally defined as young children of Macedonian nobles who attend the king. A royal page named Hermolaus planned to kill the king with four others. Even Callisthenes, Alexander's official biographer and historian, was implicated in the plot. Moreover, Callisthenes was one of the Greeks who had opposed the implementation of proskynesis, and was thus already disfavored by Alexander. Accordingly, the pages and the historian were all tortured and then executed. You might be wondering why I'm even discussing this. Why does it matter that Alexander committed all these purges? I believe it's important since it goes to show the flip side of Alexander's traits. His ambition, stubbornness, and energy, the traits that define Alexander. It portrays that there's an extreme to everything. In this case, Alexander's nature had alienated his closest advisors, and even resulted in the deaths of people most useful to him. I believe this is essential for everyone to understand, that even in the case of history's greatest figures, ambition can consume a man, and ultimately lead to one's undoing. But his undoing would have to wait for a bit. Alexander was not done yet. India remained, on the other side of the mountain range of the Hindu Kush, the jewel at the end of the known world. In 327 BC, just before Alexander embarked to India, he made a couple more decisions to further consolidate his rule over Central Asia. He married the daughter of a Bactrian warlord, Roxana. This was not only a marriage that resulted in the decline of unrest in the provinces, but also a marriage of love. According to historians, Alexander had fallen madly in love with the girl, who had been praised as the most beautiful woman in all of Asia. Now that his rule was secure and widely accepted by the Central Asian tribes, Alexander crossed the Hindu Kush through the Khyber Pass, conquering the tribes of the present-day Kunar Valley as he went, such as the Aspasians and the city of Masaga in modern-day northwestern Pakistan. Yet these battles were tough, with Alexander beginning to suffer heavier losses than he had suffered against the Persians. This was only a taste of what he would be going up against in India. Once he had overcome Masaga, Alexander finally descended into the Indian subcontinent and reached the River Indus, the greatest river in that area of the world. The Indus was a huge river valley, containing dozens of tribes and smaller kingdoms. The ruler of Taxila, an ancient kingdom here in the valley, immediately submitted to Alexander, giving him aid and support, including 200 talents of silver. With the support of the Taxilans, Alexander crossed the great river Indus and entered into the prosperous region of Punjab, where an even greater threat faced him, perhaps as large as the threat of the Persian military. This threat was called the Kingdom of the Pauravas. The Pauravas were ruled by a strong king, Porus, who had gained notoriety in the surrounding regions as a cunning and feared warrior, not to mention his wisdom, his immense height of 7 feet, and his personal strength. Porus was a commanding character, quite the opposite of Darius and Bessus. Little did Alexander know that Porus would, in some aspects, be the greatest military threat to his Macedonian army. It was May 326 BC. Alexander reached the northern banks of the river Hydaspes, now called the Jhelum, in present-day Pakistan. However, Porus had decided to stop the Greek advance by lining his army on the southern banks of the river, shadowing Alexander's every move. This wasn't a normal battlefield like at Issus or Gaugamela, but this was to be a battle where, after quickly and safely crossing the river, Alexander would have limited time to fight a consolidated force. Moreover, the Hydaspes, especially during this time of the year, was swollen and fast-moving. Alexander, realizing it would be suicidal to directly cross the river and attack Porus, would have to use trickery to outwit the Punjabi king. After a few days of being encamped directly opposite Porus, Alexander stealthily led a river crossing nearly 30 kilometers upstream with about 11,000 soldiers, mixed horse and infantry. The plan was to catch Porus by surprise with an attack on his flank, after which Alexander's general, Craterus, with a vast majority of the troops, would cross the river and attack the shocked Indians, thereby completing a pincer movement. Alexander, as always, was the first to cross. It was quite difficult, especially since the water reached the chest of the infantry and Greek hoplites. Once the smaller army had crossed onto the southern banks of the river, Alexander made his way back down south towards the encamped Porus, aiming to launch the secret attack. However, his plan had been foiled. An Indian scouting party had found him and then quickly escaped to inform Porus. Porus now knew exactly where the Greek king was. Alexander would have to face the entire Indian army with only a quarter of his men. One of Porus's sons attacked the Greeks first. However, he died after Greek horse archers decimated his cavalry corps. The Greeks, while waiting for the Indians, began to line up. As usual, Alexander led the companion cavalry on the right wing, while he placed Coenus in command of the cavalry wing, an able general who succeeded Parmenion. He placed horse archers in front of his own men, while the phalanx remained the centerpiece of the battle line. Seleucus, one of Alexander's generals who had risen through the ranks, commanded the royal shield-bearing guards. The phalanx was covered on either side by Greek archers and javelin men. With only 11,000, Alexander would have to pull out a miracle from the bag. Meanwhile, Porus's army numbered about 22 to 54,000. They fielded up to 200 armored war elephants, beasts which frightened a number of the Greeks. Though elephants were at Gaugamela, they were placed at the back of the line. Here, porous field of the massive creatures at the very front of his men. The Indians had cavalry and hundreds of chariots on either flank, with Porus himself on a chariot, as was traditional of Indian kings. It was already apparent that Porus was much different than Darius, Bessus, or even Spitamenes. He didn't cower at the back of his army, but led them from the front, much like Alexander himself. Suddenly, as you'd probably expect from him, Alexander sprung forward at the forefront of a companion cavalry charge, straight at the Indian left wing. Greek horse archers began to pepper the Indians from distance. The Indians, seeing that Alexander had charged, pulled not only their left, but also their right wing cavalry to meet the Greek companions. Heavy fighting took place as the two powers collided with each other. However, Alexander had an ace up his sleeve. He had tricked the Indians. Knowing that they would divert both flanks of their cavalry to attack the Greek right wing, Alexander had tasked Coenus to outflank the Indian right. Coenus charged, driving his forces forward and then around the now immobile Indian front line, and then attacked the rear of the Indian cavalry. The Indian horses were thrown into utter confusion, with some turning back to hit Coenus while others continued at Alexander. The sudden envelopment of the cavalry had caught them completely off guard. The Indian cavalry quickly routed, fleeing back towards their own elephants. They attempted to recharge, but were once again pushed back by Alexander. Meanwhile, as the companions had charged, the Macedonian phalanx had also begun to charge the Indian. However, the elephants countercharged, rushing towards the concentrated phalanx. This is where, arguably, the most brutal fighting of all the wars of Alexander took place. The powerful elephants, covered in armor of hardened Indian steel, caused massive losses among the Macedonians, trampling men with their colossal limbs while impaling others with their steel-armored tusks. It was complete carnage for the Macedonians. Yet the Greeks fought back bravely, with javelin men who tried to shoot the elephants in their weak point, the eyes. Finally, after what seemed like hours of intense elephant-upon-man fighting, the Indian war elephants, disorganized, routed, and charged back, trampling their own men as they escaped. Confusion now gripped the battlefield. Upon Alexander's orders, the Macedonian infantry reconnected their shields and charged as a phalanx into the remaining Indian army, while Alexander's companion cavalry, alongside Coenus, hit the Indians from the side and the rear. The Indians couldn't keep up and began to rout. However, Porus and his household guard remained at the forefront, fighting the Greek onslaught with everything he had, despite suffering multiple dangerous wounds. Finally, only after his men compelled and pleaded with him, he began to slowly retreat from the battlefield. At this point, Craterus and the Greeks still on the northern bank of the river understood that this was the pivotal point. They crossed the river and helped cut down the fleeing Indians, completing the pincer movement. It was a complete victory for Alexander. According to modern historians, the Battle of Hydaspes was Alexander's costliest battle. Around 1,000 Macedonians died, with many more injuries, the most in all the wars of Alexander. Most of these deaths came at the hands, tusks, of the Indian war elephants, which had wreaked havoc among the Greek lines. But the battle was also one of Alexander's own masterpieces, as it demonstrated his own cunning and ability to express his strengths under pressure against, literally, a bigger enemy. Yet, what was most interesting to Alexander was the performance of his competitor, Porus. Unlike Darius, Porus didn't flee when he saw his own men being pushed back, but instead fought more ferociously, invigorating the men around him. This had caught the eye of Alexander, who began to admire Porus's strength and valor. Upon the insistence of his advisors, Porus met and surrendered to Alexander. Famously, during the meeting, Alexander asked Porus, "How should I treat you?" Porus resolutely responded, "Treat me as a king would treat another king." So impressed was Alexander by Porus' bravery and strength that he made him his new satrap of the surrounding province of Punjab. Yet Alexander also suffered personal losses in the Punjab. His beloved horse, Bucephalus, had died in the battle. The horse had followed him in conquests, carrying him all the way from Macedonia to the Indian subcontinent. Alexander honored him and his legacy by, as usual, founding a city and naming it after him, Bucephala. He also founded another city in the Punjab called Nicaea. Alexander then marched on with the goal of reaching the greatest river in the Indian subcontinent, the Ganges, or the Ganga, as it's called by Indians. He intended to cross it and take on the legendary Nanda Empire, which sat on the other side of the Ganges, and controlled the vast majority of present-day India. However, at the river Hyphasis, now called the Bias, which was still hundreds of kilometers away from the Ganges, the unexpected happened. Alexander's soldiers, the Macedonians that had followed their beloved king all the way from Greece to the borders of the known world, mutinied, with Alexander's own favored general Comnenus pleading with Alexander to turn back. Following the Battle of Hydaspes, the men were tired and had been away from home for 8 years. Moreover, they had heard frightening rumors that there were armies on the other side of the wide, fast-flowing Ganges, numbering up to 1 million men, with thousands of more elephants. I think Plutarch described it the best when he said that the Battle of the Hydaspes with Porus had hurt the resolve of the Macedonians. In other words, they were literally scarred by the elephants. Alexander, whose dream it was to conquer the unknown, to continue where no man had ever ventured before, had no choice but to agree. His men were the priority, and without them, nothing would be possible. The Hyphasis River marked the easternmost boundary of Alexander's vast empire. It would end up becoming the furthest he ever visited. On his way back, he campaigned against the Malians, a tribe in the south of the Indus River Valley in modern-day southern Pakistan. Then, reaching the Indian Ocean, he split his forces. The bulk of the army he sent on fleets through the Persian Gulf to explore and report findings back to Greece. This was one of the first major Greek expeditions into the Persian Gulf, a body of water still unknown by most Greeks, which explored southern Iran and even the present-day UAE. Alexander himself took the rest of the army through the Gedrosian Desert, or modern-day southern Afghanistan and Iran, losing many thousands to lack of food and water. Alexander reached Susa in 324 BC, finally bringing an end to his Indian campaign. His holdings now stretched from Greece to the Ganges and Egypt to the Chaxartes. That would end up being the last great conquest of Alexander the Great. In August 324 BC, Alexander's men mutinied once again in the city of Opis in Persia, near the river Tigris. Alexander had resolved to send old and injured men back to Macedonia and had introduced new conscription programs throughout the empire. He instructed new soldiers to be trained in the Macedonian way of war. However, his men took this the wrong way, combined with the feeling that they would be replaced by Persians, and that Alexander was further embracing Persian culture over the Greek culture, they outright mutinied, refusing to leave. Alexander, furious at the disloyalty of his troops, ordered the ringleaders to be arrested. Then, meeting the men in the Macedonian camps, he addressed them in a rousing speech, reminding them of their victories and campaigns, of his father Philip, and the bond that he shared with these men. Their loyalty had been tested for literal years, and now they went against the very king that led them to glory. Upon hearing the incredibly moving speech, what followed was extraordinary. The men broke down, and an emotional reconciliation took place between Alexander and his soldiers. Later in 334, Alexander arranged the Susa weddings, the mass marriage of Greek and Persian nobles, to further enhance the cultural ties between the Greeks and Persians. He himself married two other women, as was normal in Macedonian culture, one of which was the daughter of Darius, the princess Barcine. However, many of these weddings barely lasted a year, with most easily breaking down. At 32 years of age, Alexander had conquered the known world. Setting out from Greece, he had Egypt, Babylon, Central Asia, and parts of India all under his thumb. But time would not allow him to conquer more. In early June, 323 BC, amid planning a future invasion of the tribes in the Arabian Peninsula, Alexander developed a strong fever. Within days, he had died. No one really knows, or even is sure, how his death came around. It was possible that he died from malaria, injuries from a prior battle or even a siege in India, or even from a case of poisoning. Yet, allegedly, Alexander, on his deathbed, was asked who should inherit his kingdom should he die. Since his wife was still pregnant with Alexander's first son, there's no clear line of succession. Alexander took a look around the room at his generals and simply responded, "To the strongest one." This very sentence, upon the death of the world's greatest ever conqueror, sparked the War of the Diadochi and the battle over who would become the true successor of Alexander the Great. I posed this question at the very beginning of the episode. What made Alexander the Great? And I think it may have the answer. Alexander was the Great because in all of human history, there's been no one like him. He became the benchmark of what it meant to be a king, a conqueror even. He showed the world that if there was anyone who could beat armies and kings quite literally twice his size, it was him. And whether it's Julius Caesar, Napoleon, or any other conqueror, there's only one man they wanted to emulate, Alexander. And to this day, no one really has. Alexander was undefeated on the battlefield, and the only thing that stopped the man that brought conquest and glory was, ironically, death itself. So, before you go, remember what made Alexander great. And remember how you can use his traits and what propelled him to the very top of the history books in your own life. I'm Mahip Mahil, and thank you for listening to this episode of Traces Your Time.